This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm News Director Sarah Bohannon. Today we're focusing on plagues of antiquity and what we can learn, if anything, from these pandemics of the past for the one we're currently living in. If you have questions or comments for us, leave them on our message line 433-9216 or go to our website, mynspr.org. For Friday, June 5th, 2020, this is special coverage from North State Public Radio. At this point in the coronavirus pandemic, you've likely heard at least one story about the 1918 flu pandemic that infected about a third of the world's population at the time and killed millions. But what about disastrous diseases that happened centuries before? Today we'll hear more about plagues of antiquity from Dr. Peter Saris. He's a professor of late antique, medieval, and Byzantine studies at the University of Cambridge in the United Kingdom. He recently spoke with NSPR's Mark Albert. Here's their conversation.
For centuries, humanity has faced periodic disastrous plagues. The bubonic plague that raged across the steppes of Asia into Europe in the 1330s is well known for wiping out 30 to 60% of Europeans, reducing population worldwide by perhaps 100 million. 800 years earlier, a similar plague struck Asia, Africa, and Europe, what's referred to as the Byzantine Empire, the Eastern Roman Empire. 65 years after the fall of Rome in 476, the empire had officially adopted Christianity and instituted reforms. Can you set the stage for us prior to the plague? Wasn't the empire enjoying prosperity?
Well, as you said, across the years of the preceding century, the 5th century, the western parts of the Roman Empire had fallen out of direct imperial rule. And in Italy, in North Africa, in Spain, and in Britain and in Gaul, you have the emergence of these new early medieval successor kingdoms. The Byzantine or Eastern Roman Empire in the early 6th century is limited, therefore, to the Eastern Mediterranean, to the lands of what's now Greece, Turkey, Syria, Egypt, and Palestine, modern Israel. So there's been a dramatic reduction in the amount of territory under direct imperial rule. And the empire is now run from Constantinople. Now, as we move into the early years of the 6th century, people in political circles in Constantinople are becoming increasingly aware that something very significant has happened in the preceding century, and that core Roman territories, most obviously Italy and Rome, have now been lost to the empire. So although the Eastern Empire is in some ways quite strong in the early 6th century, there's already a sense of political crisis in the air. The strength of the empire in the early 6th century is largely economic. Population levels are rising, the economy seems to be expanding, levels of prosperity in urban centres seem to be reaching new heights. But as I say, in political circles, I think there's a sense of insecurity, and that is then intensified in the early 6th century again by the sudden re-emergence of warfare with Constantinople's great superpower rival, the Sasanian Empire of Persia. And that also intensifies a sense of anxiety in Constantinople.
Now, the empire set out on a campaign of reconquest, attempting to retake Italy and other parts of the empire. And they were also involved in a war with Persia. And in 541, the plague began to appear. In your research, you've come across some absolutely terrifying accounts. Can you describe some of them?
Yeah, I mean, but first of all, as I say, warfare with Persia has re-emerged in the early 6th century and is one of the great dominating facts of early Byzantine history as we move across the 6th century. In the 530s, the recently appointed Emperor Justinian has taken advantage of internal troubles in the barbarian kingdoms in Africa and in Italy to seek to restore direct imperial control. So in 533, he sent armies into Africa, reconquering that territory. And in 535, he sends armies into Italy and begins the reconquest of this key imperial heartland. But then, as you say, in 541, contemporary written sources record the arrival of what appears to be bubonic plague at the Egyptian port town of Pelusium. And from Pelusium, the plague spreads to Alexandria, to one side, the capital of Egypt, and then up through Palestine, Syria, to Constantinople. And for Constantinople itself, we have two particularly important eyewitness accounts that convey both the terror that the bubonic plague caused amongst the populace of the city, and also what seems to be the massive death toll that it inflicted when it first reached there by the spring of 542.
Obviously, they did not have antibiotics, but what attempts were made to contain the outbreak or treat people? I assume that living conditions as conducive to transmission during classical antiquity as they were during the Middle Ages with the Black Death?
Well, Constantinople in particular is likely to have been very densely populated at this moment in time. The imperial authorities have been complaining about the difficulties they had preventing large-scale immigration into the city. And a number of our sources emphasize that the poor initially were most struck by the first advent of the disease. So I think in the cities of the empire, we are dealing with very dense urban populations. There you have circumstances that are very conducive to the rapid transmission of plague. As one moves into the less densely populated rural hinterlands around the cities, their transmission is likely to have been considerably slower. But in the great urban centres from which the empire was administered, Alexandria, Antioch, Constantinople, there the density of population was really very dangerous. And the contemporary accounts record that people were often afraid to leave their homes. In Constantinople in particular, our sources record how those leaving their homes would tie labels to their clothes with their names and districts on, so that if they just dropped down dead in the street, there was some chance of their family retrieving their bodies and they're not simply being dumped in the mass public graves that the imperial authorities were increasingly obliged to fall back on. In terms of caring for the dead, people don't really understand, of course, how this is transmitted, this disease, in the 6th century. A lot of the staying inside is simply due to fear. The church did maintain charitable institutions in Constantinople and other cities, hospitals for the poor, means of providing support with the supporting imperial authorities for the destitute and the elderly. But it's interesting in Constantinople that quite often we're told that priests and monks were regarded as potential transmitters or bringers of the plague. And were often treated with considerable hostility. And that's quite an interesting insight, that actually there may have been transmission in these centres of care, which, although people wouldn't have understood it scientifically, came to lead the urban poor in particular to fear many of those who might have been trying to help them.
What was the initial policy response from the emperor as this crisis was building? There's stories of people fleeing Egypt or fleeing Syria and attempting to outrun the plague and just dying en masse on the roads?
Yeah, John of Ephesus, who is one of our chief eyewitness accounts, one of our eyewitness authors, who's writing in Syriac, he is traveling, he's been in Egypt, and he's traveling up from Egypt through Palestine, Syria, Asia Minor to Constantinople. And he sort of witnesses the plague as it's spreading along with travelers, probably like his own entourage, across this terrain. And he describes quite a lot of depopulation of the countryside, people trying to avoid the plague and what have you. What's interesting is that there's a sort of a year's gap, pretty much, between the first arrival of the plague and when it reaches Constantinople. And when it does reach Constantinople, we seem to have a series of quite specific policy responses by the imperial government. At a very basic level, attempts are made clearly, they're trying to count the number of the dead. And trying to gauge the scale of the cataclysm seems to be something that the imperial authorities are very concerned with. They're trying to gather evidence for it. Although John of Ephesus tells us that once the number of dead in Constantinople reached 230,000, they simply gave up. So they're trying to gauge the scale of it. They also then start to introduce a series of sort of crisis-driven measures to respond to many of the key issues that emerge. So 542, pretty much as soon as the plague has reached Constantinople, the emperor legislates in what he describes in his laws as the encircling presence of death to make it easier for bankers and moneylenders to chase the heirs of deceased debtors. So this is one problem, that the financial system seems to be endangered as people who owe money to the banking guilds and to the moneylenders are dying and they're having to chase down their heirs. And the bankers are given a special court to give them fast-track access to justice. Then again, the following year in 543, we see Justinian making it easier for people to leave their property, as it were, to their heirs and family, and trying to address the problems caused by people dying without having made proper wills. So this suggests that now the plague is starting to have an impact on the sort of propertied classes within Byzantine society. The government then attempts to impose extensive price and wage controls to stop labourers, artisans and others from taking advantage of labour shortages to increase their wage levels or the prices for the goods they're charging. And we also have legislation to try to stop tenants on farms and estates from, again, taking advantage probably of labour shortages to negotiate for themselves lower rents. So those are the main legal responses initially. We also have an attempt to bolster the tax system by tightening the procedures whereby taxable lands that are now abandoned are assigned to new taxpayers. So we get that in legislation in 545. So from 542 to 545, we have a whole series of crisis-driven measures, primarily with a view to maintaining the key building blocks of the commercial and fiscal economy.
And so this plague took a nation that was in prosperity and enjoying a resurgence and was the leading global power and sort of knocked it off at the knees.
Well, I mean, I think what it largely does, of course, like most great external crises, is that it serves to exacerbate existing tensions and weaknesses. Yeah, it shows up what the core weaknesses in this imperial system are. So prior to the plague, Justinian's been complaining about, so the Emperor Justinian's complaining that he's finding it harder to raise the tax revenues to fight his wars against the Persians, to some extent also his wars of reconquest in the West. The plague clearly makes that much, much worse by diminishing the number of taxpayers in particular. You know, it's heightening social tensions in a society where social tensions are already running high. But I'd say more as in terms of exacerbating existing weaknesses than simply, as it were, bringing down a system which has no problems. There are problems there already. And in particular, in the years before the plague, there have been a series of earthquakes. There's also been a series of quite major climatic instability, which has also caused growing anxiety and has also contributed to, in some parts of this broader Mediterranean world, economic disruption.
You're listening to special coverage from North State Public Radio. Today we're hearing from Dr. Peter Saris, professor of late antique, medieval, and Byzantine studies at the University of Cambridge, speaking about plagues of that time. More just ahead.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from LifeLock, reminding consumers that if they've been notified that their information may have been compromised in a breach, they're twice as likely to have their identity stolen. More at lifelock.com/NPR. From EBSCO, contributor to the Folio Open Source Project, which is working to develop the open source library services platform of the future. Learn more at folio.org. And from the Annie E. Casey Foundation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Atlassian, providing collaboration software to help keep teams on the same page when teammates are cities or countries apart. More about Atlassian's products is at atlassian.com/remote. From the Vital Projects Fund, supporting the Museum of Modern Art, virtual views continue on MoMA.org with exhibition explorations including Donald Judd's sculptures and Dorothea Lange's photographs. From Progressive Insurance, offering Snapshot, a program that adjusts insurance rates based on safe driving habits. Now that's Progressive. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. And from the Annie E. Casey Foundation.
This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. Before the break, we were hearing a conversation between Dr. Peter Saris, a professor of late antique, medieval, and Byzantine studies at the University of Cambridge, and NSPR's Mark Albert, about plagues of antiquity. Let's get back to the conversation.
Now, the empire had accumulated debts and was involved in wars on two fronts and saw its population crash, along with, I imagine, suffering a lot of losses among the legionnaires. How did decision makers attempt to move forward?
Well, as I say, initially we have a series of laws trying to sort of shore up the fiscal foundations of the state. We also see as a sign of there being some sort of fiscal instability and economic weakening, a debasement of the gold coinage. We're told that one of the chief financial officers makes the gold coinage smaller, and we have a series of new gold coins that have less gold in them. And again, the small denomination coinage that most people are using has its metallic content diminished. That's the sign there being a broader fiscal crisis, which they try to address through monetary policy. But also beyond that, they really respond by trying to tighten the screws of the state, as it were, by trying to pump out still as much tax revenues as they can from the surviving population. The wars continue. There's no attempt to disengage from the warfare. And fighting on multiple fronts, when you've got fewer taxpayers to fund the army, is of course going to cause mounting difficulties. In the late 6th century in particular, after Justinian's death, when we're having repeated rounds of this plague, the government will be obliged to reduce military pay, or to try to reduce military pay by a quarter, and that will lead to major military mutinies. And we start seeing, in the late 6th century, growing fiscal instability leading to growing political instability in Constantinople.
Now, in the ancient world, cities became larger and larger and became the sort of dominant and the cultural place, but that all started to change. Was that in part due to more to the plague and fear of plague spreading, or more due to government reaction and attempts to shore up the economy? Because trade, I imagine, was decimated.
Well, in the Byzantine Empire, you're still dealing with a system where the empire is run from cities. And that urban focus of Byzantine culture doesn't change in this period. Constantinople, it's conceivable the population of Constantinople might have been halved by this cataclysm. We have estimates for reduction in the populations of other cities struck by the plague, such as Antioch, the greatest city in Syria. But I think in general terms, the urban emphasis of Byzantine and the Roman Empire remains in place. One can argue that there's archaeological evidence that many of the cities of Syria and Asia Minor are in decline as a result of the disturbances caused by plague. But this is also a period of warfare, and how we distinguish between urban decline or disruption caused by plague in the 6th and 7th centuries and disruption caused by warfare is very hard to work out on the ground. In the West, and it's important this plague is spreading to, as I say, to Italy, to Gaul, what's basically now modern France, even to England. There, the plague is spreading to communities where urbanism has really gone into, in some places, very steep decline with the breakup of Roman power in these regions in the 5th century. As you're seeing the breakup of the Roman Empire in the West, cities in the West have tended to decline. So it's not, I don't think the plague can be pointed to as it were, the key factor in the development, in the growth or disappearance of cities across this broader period.
Now, with so many people dying, the cost of labor rose, and ordinary laborers realized that they could potentially charge more for their services. And the empire eventually responded with wage controls and also, as you say, debased the currency. What were the, how did the public, do we know how the public reacted to that and what the long-term impacts were?
In Constantinople, we know that the emperor, to try to sort of steady the nerves of the citizens, issues distributions of money early on in the first outbreak to try to keep the population on side. The attempt to control wages comes in very quickly. As I say, it seems to be brought into effect in 544. I think there really the emperor and the imperial authorities, the danger is that the result of trying to roll back any gains that working people make in their living conditions has the risk of potentially heightening social tensions across the empire. I think we can see that moving forward as we move into the late 6th century. As I say, they also try to stop tenants and workers on estates from negotiating more advantageous terms for themselves from landowners. I think there's some evidence that those imperial efforts fail. I mean, if we look at the evidence of leases that survive from Egypt, for example, for this period, it looks pretty clear that tenants managed to achieve greater security of tenancy on their land than they had in pre-plague conditions. So I think the plague has a higher death rate initially amongst the poor who live in more cramped conditions and amongst working people living in more cramped conditions. For working people who survive the plague, the relative shortage of labor does provide new opportunities from which they can seek to benefit.
The cutting of military pay by 25% was something of a desperation move. And you say that led to mutiny and civil war. Were they ever able to sort of recover from that? Or I should say, how many years or decades did the chaos continue until they found a way out, and how did they?
Well, I think Justinian's crisis-driven measures in the face of the plague probably do help to give the East Roman or Byzantine state some greater resilience in the face of the plague. But at the end of the day, there's nothing he can do to resolve the fact that the successive waves of plague that ensue will continue to undermine the tax base of the empire. So when his nephew comes to power in 565, he complains that he finds the treasury burdened with many debts and reduced to exhaustion, and that this is making it hard to pay the army. As I say, in 588, a new emperor, Maurice, tries to reduce military pay by 25%, and there's a major mutiny. Maurice again in 602-3 tries to, is unpopular with the army for his austerity agenda, and he will be brought down in a military coup that year. And that coup in 602-3 opens the way for the Persians in a series of very dramatic conquests to seize Palestine, Syria, Egypt off the Romans, to seize Jerusalem and take the remains of the true cross that were kept there into Persia in captivity. And it's only through a gargantuan effort that the Roman authorities in the 620s will finally roll back those Persian gains. But that leaves the empire utterly exhausted in the face of the sudden emergence of Islam in the 630s and 640s, when the Arabs will emerge and now conquer again those key territories of the Eastern Empire beyond Anatolia and Asia Minor. So I think the fiscal exhaustion facilitates the political instability of the early 7th century. I think the same fiscal exhaustion caused by plague facilitates the civil war and opens the way to Persian invasion. And I think the efforts required to roll back the Persian armies then leave the empire very vulnerable in the face of the Arabs.
Do you think there's any lessons that we can learn or provide any insights to today?
I think there are lessons, but I think the closest similarities would be, as I say, Constantinople in the early 6th century is at the center of a whole series of much broader Mediterranean exchanges and exchange networks that go beyond the Mediterranean, as far as even England, which is pretty much the middle of nowhere by that point. Those more globalized networks of exchange are dramatically affected by this pandemic of the 6th century. So globalized patterns of exchange are dramatically diminished. Also, in general terms, the societies that are most vulnerable in the face of the plague in the 6th century are the most, in many ways, sophisticated, the most hierarchical, the most urbanized, the most monetized. Really, the more complex the society, the more vulnerable it is to this sort of sudden external dislocation or shock. The more primitive or less hierarchical societies that were clustering against the Roman frontiers, the Arabs to the south, the Slavs in the Balkans, and other barbarian groups such as the Lombards who would invade Italy in the 570s, were probably much less affected by the plague and were able to take advantage of these conditions. So sophistication, hierarchy, complexity can become counterproductive if faced with a sudden shock such as that which the Byzantines faced in the 6th century, and perhaps a similar situation pertains today.
How did the plague impact religion? I know that there was a transition kind of underway.
Yes, so we're dealing with a Byzantine or East Roman Empire, which is now officially Christian, but in which there are significant non-Christian populations still, and in which also the imperial church, the Christian community itself, is increasingly divided on issues of doctrine and faith. Now, Justinian, as emperor in Constantinople when the plague arrived, Justinian is already a very aggressively Christianizing emperor who has been cracking down on pagans, who's been cracking down on those of whose lifestyle he disapproves. He's very cruel to sexual minorities within the Byzantine Empire. And Justinian, along with a number of Christian authors, regards the plague as a punishment from God for the sinfulness of mankind. And I think the plague pushes Justinian to press ahead with his Christianizing agenda with ever greater zeal. And this means even more intense cracking down on religious minorities, on those whom he thinks are sinful due to their sexual proclivities, and also, in particular, those he thinks are heretics, who are rejecting the true definition of the Christian faith and who are thus particularly responsible for inviting divine displeasure. Across broader Christian culture, the 6th century was already witnessing a growing apocalyptic expectation, a growing belief that one was living in the last days and that soon Christ would return in glory and sit in judgment over mankind. The advent of the plague serves to dramatically intensify those apocalyptic expectations. So I think it facilitates a greater expectation of the last days, of the apocalypse, and it also confirms Justinian in his desire to recreate Byzantine and Roman society in a more fully Christian image and in accordance with a more fully Christian vision.
That was Dr. Peter Sarris, professor of late antique, medieval, and Byzantine studies at the University of Cambridge in the United Kingdom, speaking with NSPR's Mark Albert. And that is your program. As always, if you have thoughts for us, leave them on our message line 433-9216 or go to our website, mynspr.org. Today's special coverage was produced by Mark Albert, Ken Duvall, Christian Solis, Andre Bayek, Angel Haracha, Eric Radaville, Kylo Castilla, and Phil Wilkie. Our technical producer is Matt Fidler. Thank you for being with us. I'm Sarah Bohannon, news director at North State Public Radio, and this is Special Coverage. Tune in each weekday evening at 6:30 or catch the rebroadcast the following weekday morning at 8:30. Until then, stay safe, stay informed, and stay tuned to North State Public Radio.